From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 185, recorded live Monday, October 19th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, live from the Dev Days conference in San Francisco, Scott talks with Joel Spolsky, Jeff Atwood, and Rory Blythe.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes / Stack Overflow.
Joel Spolsky. Coming to you from another space and time.
And here we are, content free, backstage at Stack Overflow.
Brought to you by Telerik.
Is it brought to you by Telerik?
I don't know. I'm not in charge of your guy.
Ours is brought to you by IT Conversations.
Yes.
The conference is brought to you by all kinds of people. Stack Overflow, Carsonified, Fogbugs, Smart Bear Software, Codera paid for the Wi-Fi.
Which we didn't really get.
We couldn't turn on, but yes.
It was a nice thought.
And Microsoft. Oh, Microsoft is here in the lobby upgrading everybody's laptops.
That was sweet.
That was pretty
nice.
How
come that wasn't announced?
Because they didn't want people to bring their laptops.
Oh, I see. They didn't want to let people know. But yeah.
Too many. But now everybody who's coming to Seattle will presumably know to bring their laptop and just put in like a 16K chip or something. Be like, I got 16K.
Seriously, he's upgrading everyone to 4Gs.
He's upgrading everyone to the maximum that their laptops will hold, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That's Brandon Watson, actually, who's doing that. He's our cloud services guy.
Yeah. All part of the value proposition of the Dev Days.
This has been an episode of. So let me ask you this. It's a pretty mixed crowd. It's an exceedingly mixed crowd. It was really difficult, I felt, for me to present what I was doing because at the end, a couple of the MERB guys said, that was really great. Thanks a lot for coming. I'm still going to write MERB. Right. I mean, I wasn't here to pitch them. We were just really here to kind of chat, right?
Yeah. I mean, like my ideal of this conference is that if you're a good developer, you're constantly encountering technologies that you wish you had time to learn about and you kind of want to spend more time with. And pretty much everything we're doing, jQuery, Android, iPhone, are those kind of things that like I really need to learn something about this and see if it's that interesting. And so we thought the most appealing possible kind of conference would be like, hey, these are the 5 to 6 technologies that people most want to learn this year and haven't. And like the fewest people know, but the most people have heard of and wish they could sort of learn a little bit more about. So that was sort of the organizing theme, I think.
Well, it's also reflective of the actual user base of Stack Overflow. It's very diverse.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to pitch to people, you know, get outside your ghetto a little bit. Like, rub shoulders with how other developers do
things.
That's
the tagline? Get outside your ghetto,
that's
Stack
the informal,
Overflow?
That's the informal tagline. Not the official one. But it really is like that. I mean, you have the ghettoization where all I do is X, and I don't really know or care about any of this other stuff that's going on. Like, for example, and this might be embarrassing to admit, but like seeing Rory do Objective-C was really the first time I had really seen Objective-C and actually looked at it.
Was it the first time you'd ever seen C?
No, I've seen C before. But Objective-C is a whole different animal. It kind of made my face hurt a little, like, watching that part of it.
What are those little dashes?
Little dashes?
The lines start with a dash in Objective-C sometimes.
Okay. Yeah. So if a line starts with a dash in Objective-C, it means it's an instance method. If it starts with a plus, it means it's a static method.
Oh, okay.
It's intuitive and obvious, so.
Got it.
I would have guessed comment.
I was going to go with negative.
Using me as a probably bad example is like, this is my opportunity to get exposed to iPhone development. Like, probably literally for the first time and seeing it in like any kind of detail, somebody run through it in the IDE. Because, I mean, who has time, right? Like, I'm kind of busy with the things that I'm doing.
Yeah.
So it's nice to get sort of jolted a little bit. And that is kind of the goal of Stack Overflow. And when Joel set it up, he did a good job of matching the spirit of Stack Overflow to the spirit of the conference, I thought.
So why wouldn't I just watch it online? Say, is it the fact that we're forced into the theater and we're here like it's like a parade of different technologies? Why wouldn't I just watch it?
To get microphones working at this conference, the idea of also getting cameras recording at this conference is above and beyond.
You're not recording in heaven?
No. Well, I actually have some of it on this day, but not the people that are speaking right now.
You didn't use stream it or anything?
No.
No.
We don't have internet.
Yeah, and what
this
internet?
This is so ghetto. It's not nice to use the word ghetto for what this conference is, but it's a $99 conference.
It's an entry-level conference.
To call this conference ghetto, I think, doesn't do the word ghetto a service. Yes.
Okay.
This is not a bad conference, no, but we're trying to do it in a very economical way.
It's economic. Yeah.
You're being really hard on yourself. And
because he likes this thing, it's just so.
No, I'm serious, though. Like, after doing so many of these things, like talking about the problems with
it's very, it's very good.
I walked right in, and both times just stuck the lapel right.
Yep.
Put my mic right on me, and it worked, right? And I actually went in the back, and I was talking to Scott in the dressing room, and I had the lapel mic on the whole time. Yeah. I never switched it in or out of standby. I had no idea that it was actually on, but it turns out I wasn't broadcasting because the staff was good enough to know that.
Well, that was on Ustream. You're right. You're right.
So they didn't. They've actually been really, really good.
That's
right?
True.
Carcinified? Is that what it's called? Yeah. Carcinified? Those guys are carcinified. Yeah. Yeah, the only thing that's wrong with this conference at this point is the internet. Right. And that's every conference. No one ever expects really to get an IP address at a conference. There's no way.
Yeah, it can't be done. That's what we've discovered.
The food was really good, though. That you probably picked that.
Yeah, no,
they figured that out.
Boudin, well, that's okay, because awesome. It was not good in LA, so we're making up for that.
Yeah, but it was good here. In Boston. It was good in
Well, what's the plan for Seattle on Wednesday?
I don't know. I get surprised by this every time. We'll see who we have. You? Rory?
Rory.
Not Jeff. Me? There'll be a few others. We got an academic guy, Steve Seitz, from University of Washington.
Right. You look tired.
Yeah.
Are you tired?
I'm also kind of tired. Yeah.
Tell them your schedule.
I don't even know my schedule. Oh, every other day. Yeah, I'm basically doing one of these conferences Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for 3.5 weeks. Yeah. So that's what's kind of killing me.
Hey, I have an idea. Since this has gone nowhere in 14 minutes, and even though Rory is raising his hand, you have a question?
Is this the first conference you've ever put on?
Pretty much.
Okay, you really do need to be using yourself.
Yeah,
this
you're
is
doing
going
fine.
Very well. I mean, yeah, I'm just saying.
So,
thanks.
What's all this about duct tape?
Oh, we're going to talk about content. Like, this is going to be substantial.
Otherwise, I'm just going to delete it.
Duct tape. I think people misunderstood what I meant about duct tape. Duct tape is a simple tool that gets something done. And the duct tape programmer, I like invented that word instead of saying quick and dirty programmer or anything like that, because that's not what I meant. I meant this is a different kind of programmer who is always afraid to use like these latest gadgets that they just heard about on Hansel Minutes the week before that just came out, which are awesome. Don't get me wrong. But sometimes you have a really critical project and you're trying to get it to work. Listen, let me give you an example just from the conference, all the audiovisual of the conference. You've got, and we know this is podcasters. We all know this is podcasters. This is a real mic. This is a professional mic. This connector
is. Yeah, thanks for that.
Am I back? Am I back?
Yes,
you're back. That's an XLR connector. It's balanced. There are three wires going through here because it's balanced.
It's not from Radio Shack.
It's not from Radio Shack. You could get maybe no, not this nice. And you got it plugged into decent M Audio gear. Now we could be using one of those little Radio Shack cheapo or Kmart microphone, you know, that comes like my first karaoke machine. And you could have it plugged into a laptop, and you'd be like, "What's wrong? It's a laptop. It's got a little mic port on the side." And you could try to do a podcast that way. And it'd kind of work. And after 15 minutes, your little recorder app would crash, or just things would go wrong. And the same thing happens at a conference. You got kind of high-end AV tools, high-end video tools, high-end internet access. And if you don't have that, then it doesn't work. And so the internet access they have here is an Airport Express. That's a consumer-grade thing. That's not a high-end thing. And it just falls down. It doesn't.
So what about duct tape?
So the duct tape programmer says, listen, I know that you've got your fancy digital gigaw that I can get for only $19.95, and it's all awesome, and it lets me run my whole conference digitally, and all the mics could be digitizing right here and sending it onto an IP network and blah, 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 blah. And they never, ever do that at real conferences and real shows and real plays. They use the same old school. This XLR thing was invented in 1903 or something. I mean, it's the same exact interface that's been around since the beginning of time. No,
which was 1903.
Well, I don't know. Since the beginning of like electronics, yeah. The XLR is a ridiculously old interface.
I think Bruce Dickinson.
It's from the oldie days of radio.
Right. Before the three of us were born.
Certainly. And that stuff still works. It's like simple.
So let me make sure I understand. So it's about two things. It's about pro level versus consumer level.
Yep.
It's also about tools that have like a long history of being well established.
And well understood. So there's a guy, the guy doing the mic, Rory, that you were saying was doing an awesome job, and he knew to cut you off and stuff like that. He's been on the road. He's been a roadie for 30 years. He's been doing rock concerts.
He has he had that look. I mean, I looked at him, and he looks like a roadie who's been doing this for.
Yep. And not just that, you didn't even catch this, but in the morning, he had a way of talking to you that put you at ease about the AV, which he's learned after 30 years of how to make the performers not stress out about the equipment. And, you know, just that kind of like telling little funny jokes and stuff like that, and just basically calming everybody down around him.
Bedside manner.
Bedside manner, exactly. And that's just like, it takes a lot of experience. It takes a lot of, and he's not going to use some new crazy ridiculous. He's just going to plug in, and you're going to be like, why don't you have this all on a big old audio IP network? With super, and then instead of having 400 of these cables going from the front of the house to the back of the house, you got one little Cat 5, which somebody steps on, the whole thing goes down, and nobody knows what happened because it's interfering with some who knows what. And with the XLR, it's a it's a solved problem. It's a well-known problem, the balanced cables and whatnot.
So it's also known versus unknown. New stuff tends to be less well-known, less tested, just by virtue of being newer.
Yep.
It's kind of a little bit suspect, even though it's better.
Yeah, ultimately it will be better. Ultimately, when we may want to use it. It may win.
So is this about picking a technology to get the job done at the appropriate level in the adoption curve? Like, for example, I picked Vonage.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And it sucked.
Yeah.
For about 5 years.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't had a problem with Vonage for the last year.
So you got one out of six great years.
No, but in all seriousness, though, it's solved now. Voice over IP worked, but it took a half decade to like pull it off.
Right. And that's I think people don't realize how long it takes for some of the technologies that we're using in code to like get to that point where you understand it well enough. I mean, we're always, especially given the web and the nature of things going on. See your computer just.
So my computer, so you're going to tease me now. My computer is just either falling apart.
Yeah. No, it just it's just like screensaver time now. I'm not plugged in.
I don't know what's going on.
But that you can't have that happening in a conference. In fact, it did happen this morning. A little movie stopped in the middle because
because this is actually a battery for that.
Oh,
I see.
These require phantom power.
So it's also your iPhone battery, isn't it?
Yes, that is my portable battery pack / laptop.
I remember one of my favorite photos is Scott carrying around a little, like a ultra mini PC and like using it to power his iPhone while he's talking. He's like, this is my battery pack for my iPhone. So, yeah.
So why did people get all in a twist about the duct tape programmer?
I think that what they saw the duct tape programmer and they thought of the style of programming where you just slap some duct tape on something. And that is something that a duct tape programmer will do because A, duct tape is well understood. And B, sometimes it is, you're in a rush to ship. So that your company doesn't go out of business and it is worth incurring technical debt, right? Like everybody's saying technical debt these days as if that's a bad thing. You're going to have to pay that down. But technical debt, another way of looking at it is technical leverage. It allows you to get code done more quickly so that you can ship it. Now, then there are people that are just really, really determined to say that being an extremely slow and cautious developer and writing TDD tests for all your getters and setters is, actually makes you write code faster. And most of the good developers I know, many of the good developers I know don't actually think that way. Now I just got myself in trouble without even getting myself out of trouble. But, what happened is that people read the article about the duct tape programmer and they said, Joel's about to write saying dirty programming is good, sloppy programming, gunslingers, fastest gun in the West, whatever, bad, crappy programming is good. And that is not what I was saying at all whatsoever.
So it seems like if you had said something more like software craftsmanship is good or the Yankee Workshop is a great show on PBS.
Would have been really boring.
Well, I know. So the title was link bait.
Oh, no. But it had to be.
I shop at IKEA and I come home and I sit on my IKEA couch and I watch the Yankee Workshop. And I see how this guy is like using like the tools that Laura Ingalls Wilder's grandfather used to make. You know, and he works for 6 months to make a chair, and that chair will live forever.
Yeah.
And don't you kind of sit on your IKEA couch and, gosh, wish
that you had that tool?
Maybe I had that kind of tool or that talent or that the whatever the work is?
Sometimes. Sometimes it's worth doing, and sometimes it doesn't make sense because you're just opening a coffee shop that's going to have the best coffee in Portland, and you want to get a couch that people can sit on so that you can open it, and you have X dollars. And having the nicest craftsman, blah, 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 is not going to bring you any closer to having a successful coffee shop. So you kind of have to decide. And sometimes you're not everything. It's not always appropriate to use the most gold-plated tool in the world for what you're doing. Sometimes it's worth just knocking something out and getting it out to the people so they can use it and try it and give you money for it.
I just want to say I'm also totally not advocating that people go out and just do really sloppy job stuff, but
yeah.
And I'm not naming any names or any people or any companies, but I have been involved in some projects since leaving Microsoft where there were times when...
Since leaving Microsoft.
Yeah. Since leaving Microsoft. Where there have been times when release of software was delayed because there was a perfectionist aspect to the code. And mm-hmm. the reality is when users are using your stuff, like they don't know what it looks like underneath and they don't care if it works. And if it's not perfectly done, it doesn't really matter. Like get it out there and then give yourself like the version 2 release to prettify it.
Maybe that comes right back to this whole conference, which is I'm sitting here stressing out like crazy because all kinds of stuff is not working behind the scenes. But the bottom line is the speakers are on stage and they're teaching people stuff and their laptop is being projected on the monitor and the people are sitting in the audience and learning. And that's all we need.
Well, yeah, you're stressing out about stuff that I had no idea was even going on.
You didn't even know it was going on. And you're a speaker, let alone a...
Yeah. And it feels... I didn't detect any problems, so yeah.
Yeah.
We arrived. I walked on stage. The equipment worked. And I did my talk. People applauded. I stepped off. I didn't have a problem with anybody. It was as smooth as ever.
Yeah.
Except for the wireless.
Except for those MERB guys.
Right.
And those darn MERB guys.
What's a MERB again?
It's a MERB? It's another MVC framework, like for like Rails, but it's not Rails. It's
MERB. I thought Rails itself was okay. It's another Ruby. It's Ruby.
I think it's a Ruby MVC framework.
It's an MVC framework.
Yeah. Okay,
but it's fun. It's more fun to say MERB than it is to say Rails.
So they use it.
It sounds like a guy. It sounds like some dude named MERB is out there.
If I state my opinion of the Ruby. Programmer.
This is the end of me.
It's gonna be absolutely the end of me.
Four brains in a room thing has turned into let's see what wacky stuff we can get Joel to say.
All right, I'm giving up the microphone here to Rory. He hasn't spoken.
Oh yeah. Yet. So when it comes down to what wacky stuff can we get someone to say, let's give the mic to Rory.
Okay, could you give me like a question or something? Do you just want me to extemporize? Because so I can do that for hours. I can just talk for hours. Seriously. I'm sorry, what?
I think
your sister was here, wouldn't
you? My sister was here. Which is most exciting.
Your sister's a programmer?
She's not exactly a programmer. She worked for the San Francisco bar. She was like a clerical worker. And
like the bar?
The San Francisco bar. The whole, you know, the attorney.
Like the
thing,
lawyer.
Right? Oh. Yeah, no, yeah. She's not like, yeah, the bar. No, it's a whole attorney referral service. And she wasn't a coder. She was just doing like data entry and she didn't like the data entry after using those written access. So she went and decided to just rewrite the thing. Without asking anybody. And eventually changed the way that her department was doing their business. And then
Classic software engineering story.
No, it was awesome. And some people were so impressed that they were like, hey, why don't we go off and start a business? So now she runs a business that specializes in providing web and software services to people in the legal profession. She doesn't actually code like code, but yeah. I went to her office yesterday and she has jQuery books on the shelf, which wow. I was like, sis has jQuery books, man. Like that was weird. No, he's right. Seriously, yeah, no, there's stuff my sister knows that I don't, and she just picked it up out of nowhere.
How dare she?
But she started coding almost before I did, right? Back in 1984, I think it was 83, 84, she wrote her first app, and like she kind of got me going. And so it was neat to have her here. It was really neat to have her here, and I don't know, she dug it.
So wait, is there any truth? Your sister actually wrote a program before you did?
I was writing software for the Timex Sinclair 1000 mm-hmm. in 1983, and she wrote the first app on an IBM PC. She beat me to that. All right. And I saw what she did and I was jealous. And yeah. Then I went and I one-upped her and then I two-upped her. And then it was a factor of, you know, a bajillion. So
well, remember that the Timex Sinclair 1000 was the programming language where instead of saying print, which would take 5 bytes, you wrote P period to save 3 bytes.
Well, they had the weird keyboard where yeah. you didn't actually type. You would hit.
There was a button that said print.
Yeah, that would just yeah. stick everything. Yeah, it was bizarre. And you had to retype it every single time because you had no storage format. Now it's just upgraded to, I think, 2K
yeah.
of RAM. It was a great platform for learning because yeah. you had to write your app every single time you wanted to use it.
It was a lot like those calculators that they had in those days, that, you know, like the TI, there's a Texas Instruments programmable calculator and the HP 65 and. You know, you had about 100 instructions that you could store. You have to retype them every time.
But this hooked up to the TV.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I wrote a spreadsheet for one of those. No, just kidding.
Speaking of missing stuff, I miss when programming was, like, hard. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't, like, building stuff with Legos when you were actually inventing new kinds of Legos.
You know what's funny is how many we have speakers. How many of the speakers today were basically doing, like, your first VB 1.0 app? Like, oh, look. And then I clicked the cute guy, the iPhone. I mean, well,
the iPhone guy.
Yeah. Explain who the cute guy was.
The cute guy was Daniel Rocha.
He wasn't cute.
No, no, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Okay. I don't get in trouble.
QT
is Nokia's, well, now owned by Nokia.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Apparently pronounced Nokia.
Yeah, it's definitely Nokia.
Is it really?
Yeah, well, in Finnish, yeah.
Oh, didn't know that.
I didn't know he spoke Finnish.
See all the things you can learn at the Stack Overflow Dev Days?
So what did he actually do? What happened?
He basically made an app that was one of these Hello World, like, look what I did in VB 1.0. I just made an edit box, and when you click on it, it adds it to the list box below there. And his was kind of cool because it ran on Symbian devices, and it ran on Unix, and it ran on Mac, which he didn't show, and it ran on Windows. But, I mean, we're still doing these... We're still coming up with these new frameworks and everything like that. And the demo that gets everybody started, it is always like, you know, look how I have a box, an edit box that sends a text parameter to a method on some other box that's on this page. And that's kind of what all these apps do. It's all Visual Basic 1.0.
It is, you know, kind of beginner. No, it is. And that's the exciting thing. And that's why I've always liked mobile. Yeah. Like when I went to the Pocket PC back in the day and it was just embedded Visual Basic and embedded Visual C++. You really had to make a lot of stuff up. And that's one of the reasons I enjoy the iPhone, is that it's actually still hard, right? And
you like the iPhone because it's hard to develop for.
And you have to deal with, like, you know, pointers.
It's funny. When I was working in Visual Basic 6, the thing that I enjoyed the most was working on the Palm Pilot at night.
Yeah.
And one of the applications that I worked on in the Palm Pilot, because I had, like, 4K a stack, and I did the whole thing in C, the most, you know when you have a programming experience where you, like, lift your hands in victory, like hero on heroes? Like one of those experiences, it was drawing a circle. Because the iPhone, the iPhone. The
was it Glucometer?
Pilot, it was the GlucoPilot application.
Okay.
I wrote an application for diabetics on the Palm Pilot. And what was significant about it was that there was no floating point and there was no math library. So I had to take an integer and chop it in half and do fixed point math. And then the screen was like 160 by 160 pixels, like an old QuickTime movie.
Yeah.
But there was talk about it going to 320 by 320, which was going to be huge. So I wanted to be future-proofed. Yeah. So what I ended up doing was building an array in like a static resource that described a 1,000 by 1,000 circle and then scaled it appropriately and then wrote cosine and sine stuff. And then I was like, all right, now I'm ready to draw some dots, right? And, well, there's no get pixel or put pixel on the early Palm Pilot, so then you're XORing it directly to memory, you know what I mean? And then you go and you show your wife, hey, I drew a circle on this tiny device. She's like, yeah, great. And you've been up how many nights? And this is paying the mortgage how? But man, the victory, you know what I mean? The accomplishment.
Well, one thing I would like to comment on is that there's so much mobile here. I mean, it's really surprising how much energy there is in the mobile space that wasn't really there 3 to 4 years ago. So between web and mobile, it's like, what happened to the executable style? Or, you know, it's like, where did that go? This seems to be where all the energy is right now. And just one comment on the iPhone stuff.
It's 10 times the penetration, right? Like, you're going to reach 10 times as many people on any little cell phone device as you ever can.
Because it's their computer.
Yeah. Because it's even our computer, right? Everybody who has a laptop has a phone, and then there are all these people that just have phones.
It's their phone, too. Yeah. I think that's the other crucial thing, is that they have phones.
Right.
They got to have phones.
Yeah.
So. I was in Tanzania last Christmas, and we were driving between Arusha, Tanzania, and the southern border of Kenya to pick up my brother-in-law, and we were out in the middle of nowhere, and I'm getting uncomfortable, and the brakes overheat. And the driver is pouring cold water on our brakes. And we're standing in the middle of nowhere. And I mean, there's no bigger words than that. I'm like, I am alone with this driver in freaking Kenya. That's why I look at my phone.
Were there like skulls by the side of the road with the vultures that picked clean?
It was pretty much exactly like that. There's African, what are those tumbleweeds going by and stuff?
Wild
and then I see a guy in the distance, like, all right, now I'm going to get killed by a Maasai.
Yeah.
Well, he was walking by, full Maasai regalia, the whole thing, texting. He's texting. So I look at my BlackBerry, and it says Kenya cell, 5 bars. Wow. Cool. You could not see anything in any direction, and we had 5 bars.
Yeah.
And people were chilling.
Yeah.
And they use SMS over there.
Well, because that's the best way to get onto Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. That's all my Maasai friends are twittering. No, but they do market. They have a complete eBay marketplaces on SMS where they'll use short codes to describe what they're selling and hook up with other people who are selling stuff. What?
I was going to say, don't they also, they have like these little one-person mobile phone companies too.
We're talking about African.
Yeah, I'm talking about like the one person who has the cell phone. They like lease out cell phone time to the other people.
Right,
the,
so if you're...
It's not called a neighborhood,
we're
is
talking
it,
about Africa, we're not talking about like the city, right? Like if you go to the city, you can get an iPhone. I was in Johannesburg and they have an iPhone and they have Windows mobile phones and they've got 3G and they're having a great time.
No, I'm talking about the middle of nowhere where there's that one person who has the phone, yeah.
Yeah, so the person who owns a phone can set up a little table, and what they do, what they actually had there in Tanzania was a desk phone with a cell phone adapter. So basically you have like this cell phone that is just a place to plug in your desk phone. And they would set up a cardboard box on the side of the road and they would say it's like one Tanzanian shilling per minute and you can talk on the phone. And you just sit there on a desk phone in the middle of nowhere.
And the cardboard box is for shade?
No, the cardboard box is what the phone's sitting on.
Oh, okay.
but it's back to your point. It's all about communication. And there's actually a buddy of mine who's got a project called the Kamusi Project, which is trying to make an online Swahili dictionary, and he wants to make it available via SMS so that someone who doesn't speak English could text an English word to the dictionary and then get back the equivalent word in Swahili. Cool. That would be like an example of a really cool app that you could write that would not necessarily be like an iPhone app. It would be more like a text gateway.
Well, they're also using it for doing things like, I know that in India, to ensure the produce, like, so they don't purchase more inventory, say, like, dairy perishable items than they could ever actually use. Like, they've got these really complicated networks of people who are just SMSing each other and ordering, like, a certain amount of dairy based on a certain amount of orders, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's kind of bizarre, like, how totally integral the whole thing is. Like,
it's like FidoNet for dairy.
Yes!
It's just like FidoNet over SMS for dairy in India.
Yeah, no, that's what it was like.
I hope that our listeners can write in the comments about if you are, in fact, from Africa or from India or from way out in the middle of nowhere to validate that we're not just a bunch of white guys talking about stuff we don't know about.
So Africa and India are nowhere? Is that what you're saying, Scott? Ooh,
I'm saying that
remote locations.
Africa, India, and then also South Dakota. That's what
I'm saying. Okay.
Yeah. Safe. Do we have any South Dakotans here tonight? Where does John Sheehan?
I don't know.
Yeah, he's from Minnesota or something. He's probably from Minneapolis.
My brother lives outside Portland in the middle of nowhere. And he moved out there so he could have a couple of acres and everything. And they've been out there, 3 months now? And they finally broke. And his wife called me and he's like, I need internet. Yeah. There's 24.4. Is that fast? I'm getting 24.4. Is that good? I'm like, I think that your cables are dirty. Someone needs to go and scrape the copper. So they're going to go either satellite or DSL, and they're only 3 miles out of town.
Can they get DSL? Or how does it work? Actually, you know what? The cable has much better penetration. Yeah. And
From what I remember, it's about distance from the central office.
DSL has limited distance over copper, but cable works better.
Hey, everybody. This is Scott coming at you from another place in time. No doubt you probably bump into testing tasks now and then in your work. And you know, writing functional tests is probably not your favorite thing. It's kind of difficult, takes time, and the results can be dubious. Well, get ready to start liking tests thanks to Telerik with the new WebEye testing framework. Building web automation tests is a breeze. You've got code automation with advanced ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight applications. You can write a single test, have it executed against multiple browsers at once. You benefit from a rich API. There's link support, integration with Visual Studio unit testing, also NUnit, XUnit, and MBUnit, not to mention the free wrappers for Telerik RAD controls for ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight, all shipping with Telerik's new testing tool. One of the best features, the WebEye testing framework, which is developed by Art of Test, is it's absolutely free. If you've already got hooked on WebEye testing framework, start using it right away. Go to Telerik.com for more info. Thanks a lot.
Staying with the theme of mobile development, so I really enjoyed Rory's iPhone presentation, but I got to admit, I was really kind of horrified, like, by Objective-C. And you sort of hinted at this. You're like, well, I'm going to start repeating a lot of stuff, and I'm going to do this stuff over and over. And I'm going to use all these brackets that kind of make sense. And I thought you had a good way of explaining it. And I think it was neat. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the juxtaposition of Objective-C. I'm going to hand it over. Objective-C versus Monotouch, which that seems to be sort of like the new hotness of like, maybe this will get simpler. Because I looked at it and went, wow, that's cool, but that's like kind of like a little bit further back in time. All your 80s analogies, like Back to the Future. It's a little bit further back in time than I want to go. So,
okay. So I got in some trouble when I did the .NET Rocks episode where they interviewed me about iPhone development.
Yeah, because and then I listened to all those things you said, and I repeated them on our stupid podcast. And Miguel was like, yeah, that's true.
Yes, you got us in trouble.
Well, that's the thing. No,
like, so we're just all spreading wrong information.
Okay. So I'm talking to Carl, and you know, we're just making conversation, and I'm thinking this is a show for .NET developers. Yeah. So I'm presenting the information from the point of view of a .NET developer. What does mm-hmm. a .NET developer need to know about iPhone development, right? And the first thing is that Objective-C is nothing like any .NET language you've ever used. And to me, it was a little bit scary, right? Mm-hmm. You're getting away from your fancy, easy dot notation. Right. Properties are a completely different thing. Everything has a different name. Right, an interface from .NET is called a protocol in Objective-C. A method is a message, and they actually are technically different. There's all these just weird, bizarre things, and they're holdovers from like 1986. And that's why I say that installing the iPhone SDK is like installing a flux capacitor inside your computer. Right, you just go back in time and you code like it's the 1980s again.
Right,
and
was there.
Yeah, and yeah, and And I actually, at first it scared me, but I started to really enjoy it because of that bizarreness. Again, we were talking about it being, you want a program to be hard again, you should learn Objective-C with me. Yeah. I've been working with Chris Sells actually weekend after weekend, doing iPhone development with him. And we've just been banging our heads on keyboards, at times.
Yeah, Chris Sells is a pretty smart guy.
Chris Sells is brilliant, right? But there are things that we run up against that are
But the guy who wrote the iFart app, he's not.
We're not even going to talk about that.
No, but I mean, apparently iPhone developers isn't that freaking hard because, people are doing it.
Right? No.
Wait. There's a certain level of iPhone. Like the first year or so of iPhone development is going to be people writing dinky little apps that takes them 16 minutes to drag together the things and selling them for 99 cents. And that's going to work for a year or so because there's no competition. But the minute, you know, as the platform matures, you have to write some pretty good apps to beat up. I mean, you know, I just think about like you want to have a little application to track, how much you weigh every day. But pretty soon that becomes, you know, all the exercises that you did that day. And then it's got to have videos showing you how to do more exercises. And then it's got to have a measure your biceps feature and all kinds of stuff. The stuff just gets added. It becomes more and more complicated. And at some point, you have to be a good developer. But in the early days, you can get away with some little dinky things.
Well, and point being, the flashlight app was okay at some point. Right? And you can create...
No, it was never
That's a good point, too. You can create the flashlight app, though, with new project, and you're done. And that's it. You've got a flashlight app. Yeah. So you could do that. But as you go along, not only is the functionality more important, but performance is a big deal. Right? Sure. So there are people who are going to use a lot of the built-in convenience of the whole view system to build a table, for example. If you do that, you're going to have a chunky, terribly scrolling table that is...
So it's not like it doesn't come out perfect and pretty right off the bat?
Right. You end up having to bypass all that and go straight to the CAPS.
See, I juxtapose this to the time when I tried to move my Palm Pilot application, when the Palm Pilot was dying, from C to C Sharp on the little Windows mobile phone. And it took me like 3 days to like put together a nice little blood sugar application. Grid, detail. The problem was it was ugly.
Hmm.
But from like a productivity perspective, it was ridiculous.
He had his string type and everything. It was probably very exciting. Yeah.
You guys don't have string?
Because there's a string type. There's a problem.
There is.
But you know what I'm saying? It's just interesting that people will work hard at something that looks pretty, but they will not do the easy thing that looks ugly.
When you get into it, though, like my iPhone, when I go and I download an iPhone app, I get so easily offended now. Because I know what it takes. I know what it takes to build one of these things, and I know what people are doing, and it horrifies me.
Why?
Like that.
You're like angry at an application?
Yes. Okay. I'm angry at the app, but by proxy, I'm angry at the person who made it. Okay. And, I'm angry at how lazy, you know, people are, how little research they do. Like, there are all these guidelines to make the apps usable, right? To make them look good, to make them usable, to make them consistent, from one app to the other, so you never need to have a manual. And a lot of people don't even bother to read the most basic documents to make that happen. And as a result, the App Store is just packed with garbage. Like, really? Almost everything in there is garbage.
There's a lot of, well, that's just because people are writing unfunctional
things. It's like SourceForge.
It is like SourceForge. It's a graveyard of broken technical dreams. Yeah.
This is Scott the Scott, not Scott the Microsoft guy. But yeah, I mean, the iPhone App Store is like SourceForge, where it's like, we've got 86,000 apps and 1% of them are interesting, and you should care about them.
Yeah, but that's so much better than the Windows Mobile world.
We used to have on Windows Mobile, where if there were 86,000 apps, they were some of them are good and some of them are bad, and they didn't even have consistent user interfaces. And
they were on 86,000 different sites.
Yeah,
right?
So yes, actually, and that was the worst problem. You couldn't even find them. Couldn't even track them.
Yeah, you had to go find them.
And you were like, and then it didn't work because it was missing a button. You didn't have a button on your phone that you needed to use this application.
But Mono.
Yeah.
Mono Touch.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Mono Touch is actually exciting to me for almost the same reason that just Objective-C development for the iPhone is, and that Mono Touch is brand new, mm-hmm. right? And those guys are geniuses. Like, I want to say that. I mean, they are seriously freaky smart people. And it's a version one product. It does you can write a pretty solid app with it. There's some stuff that's missing, right? But that's one of my favorite parts.
Right.
I mean, one of my favorite parts is finding the bits of the CocoaTouch framework that they did not bind for MonoTouch and writing the bindings. Mm. I don't know why. I must be sick, but I what really enjoy that. Okay, so if you want to use a CocoaTouch type, like if there's, for example, the serialization bits in Cocoa, the libraries for the iPhone, they're very different from any kind of .NET serialization.
Well, can I interject? Isn't it just like wrapping the Windows API? Like there's something you want to call in the Windows API that's not exposed in the .NET framework?
It's
so you have a wrapper?
Yeah.
It's almost like that, except that because you're dealing with a completely... they've got to pass everything through the Objective-C runtime, right? So they've got a wrapper around the Objective-C runtime. They've got a set of attributes that they use to either export types to the Objective-C runtime or make Objective-C Cocoa types available to .NET, right? It's just fascinating. And there's some things you just can't do right now, and that's one of my favorite parts, right? And those guys are going to they're gonna fix it. You give those guys 2 months, 3 months, and the mono guys are going to have everything ported over that's going to be necessary. But right now, if you really want to write an app that's going to be able to like save state properly, restore properly, be performant, you're going to have to do some extra work.
It's like writing for the Palm Pilot again, where it's like you could be shut down at any moment.
But it's not that. It's not quite that, right? Because the things that you can do, you really do write half the code. Like Miguel loves to talk about properties, and it's a great example because in the Objective-C world, you have to write your local in your header file. Then you got to write the property declaration that's going to represent it, and then you've got to put the synthesized statement in the implementation file.
See, and then just, you get to use it. You're just talking right. I mean, you're translating stuff from English to Japanese and back into English again. I have no idea what you're saying.
It's a million steps, and just to hook it up to a UI component that exists in Interface Builder is a whole extra set of steps. With MonoTouch, you go to Interface Builder, which is their UI designer. You create your button or whatever it is, and you give it. We'll just call it, you give it a name. It's called an outlet, but we'll just say a name. And MonoTouch, as soon as you save that interface file, will generate a partial class that will make all of those UI components available to you as properties, and you don't have to wire anything up anyway.
It's like WinForms, and how WinForms is really a very, very light framework on top of Win32.
It is.
It's all a lie, but there's so many things that were hard in Win32 that are just done for you.
It's not a lie, though, because CocoaTouch, like, you cannot do things the .NET way for the iPhone, or else you're going to be wrong. If you try to write like a .NET app for the iPhone, you're going to screw up. Like the point isn't to make it possible to write .NET apps for the iPhone; it's to be able to write iPhone apps using .NET. Right? I don't know if that makes sense, but string manipulation, date manipulation, right, all of that is so much easier with .NET.
It makes me wonder when you see something like that, you must be wondering if the people at Apple that engineer this stuff have ever looked at any other programming frameworks other than the one they're using, because they haven't figured out some of the stuff that was invented 20 years ago to make programming easier. And it happens in the other direction too, of course.
Yeah, we're not going to get mail for this show at all.
No, but it's really true. Okay, I can understand if they said, look, we just haven't had time to fix up Objective-C and to add these following features. But sometimes.
Only 20 years.
You look at these application frameworks and the stuff is, they don't even seem to be aware that certain technologies have been invented in programming languages, in application frameworks. Things like, this stuff is starting to show up in C#. So C# 3.0 is classic. Certain things that are starting to show up in C#, like a little bit of type inference, which was invented in probably, well, I was first learning about it in college. So Haskell, 1988 or something, the idea of type inference, which the only place it showed up in C# is the var statement, and then it infers the type.
We have dynamic now. We have a statement called dynamic.
What does that do?
It's statically typed as dynamic. So if you have something and...
That's a variant.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Okay. Mm. That's another invention.
It's an I dispatch point. It's not a com I dispatch, but I'm putting it in Joel terms.
Okay. So it's a thing that can... It's a variable.
Yes.
That can
hold in Joel's world, it's a variant.
Okay. I'm sorry, I have to go back to 10 years because I haven't paid attention to anything since
visual. A var is compile time.
Correct.
Right? Dynamic is totally dynamic.
Understood. So var is a feature called type inference where the compiler actually figures out what type something
is. Var is syntactic sugar.
It's syntactic sugar, and it's only partially implemented in C#, for example. Can you do it? You can't use it for a parameter.
No.
Okay, that's not there yet. But there are programming languages such as Haskell and ML.
How would you use it for a parameter?
You would say var x.
No, but how would you know how someone was going to call you? Two guys could call you differently.
only one of them would work because inside the code, you would be saying x equals 12 and it would know that it's an int, or you would be saying printf x and it would know that it's a string.
You couldn't know that because two people would call you from two different places and what the one who gets
it's
first.
Not who's calling you. It's what you're doing with the variable and you're using that variable in places. And it turns out that you can deduce what type that thing is supposed to be. And if this sounds bizarre to you, go look at Haskell or ML. There are languages that do this completely, 100% type inference. And B, we got Wasabi, which is a language that some idiot at some kid at Fog Creek Software wrote.
I don't know what does full type inference.
All right, I'm going to have Anders is going to call you now, and you're going to arm wrestle.
Does Anders say you can't do type inference? Is he not?
You could. I'm not saying you can or can't do. I'm just saying here, as a layman, as a non-compiler designer, as a person who doesn't own a multi-million-dollar company in New York. I'm just trying to think about the logistics of parameter type inference.
Okay, so you get a parameter. It says var x. What do you do with x? You could call another function, right?
Maybe I return x. Maybe I x plus plus.
X plus plus is an plus plus is an integer operation.
No, plus plus is an operator. I could have operator overloading.
That's a good question. Okay, well, I don't know if Haskell has operator overloading, and sometimes it's true that sometimes these languages, like if you look at OCaml. It's very bizarre in that there is...
Talking to you is like talking to a college professor.
Wait, hold on. Like, there's I think I'm sort of dumb, so it might help for me to give the dumb version. Like,
we may find when the listeners hear this show that we're all dumb.
You just look at how somebody's calling the function, right? And you can figure out from that what kind of data is being passed in, right? And either it's going to work or it's not. And that's...
Let me tell you, the Wasabi programming language developed at Fog Creek is VBScript, where nothing is, some things are tightly bound, but they don't have to be, and it does full type inference. So, it is possible in VBScript, like languages.
Then why doesn't it compile more than one application?
Well, that's just because we didn't bother implementing
It's a domain-specific language. Joel was just way ahead of his time.
It's a domain-specific language that compiles into one application.
Because we only use it for one application.
Why don't you give it to the world?
Because it sucks. But
there you go. You heard it here first. Good night, everybody. Tip your waiter.
That's the best. You know any podcasts I've done with Joel? That's the single best thing he's ever said, and I love it. That has to be published somewhere.
If you were trying to make,
I want t-shirts made. Wasabi, it sucks.
Exactly. You should be wearing that shirt.
If you had to invent a language whose only goal of this language was to compile the source code that you already had, you wouldn't bother implementing all kinds of useful language features.
We've done this before. I'm with you, brother. I'm with you. Here's the thing. I know why you wrote Wasabi, and I agree, and I'm with you. But to then declare it a superior general-purpose language is a bit of a stretch.
I just said try that we did type inference. The type inference is possible.
Try compiling n plus one applications, and then
proof.
We'll talk.
It is an existence proof of type inference.
Okay.
It proves that you can infer types.
To be clear, we're not talking about it. I mean, everyone understands you can do type inference.
Yeah.
You just said you couldn't
figure out how to do it with a parameter.
I just said with parameters, it might require a little more thought.
What is the difference between calling a function with a parameter and assigning to a variable?
Because you can call it, I can pass in, because I could call foo with a string and foo with a, and foo with, with another variable called a and foo with a number, three different times in the same application.
You're going to have to generate three different, if that's going to ever be tightly bound.
We have to put a stop to the armchair language design. This has to stop.
You can't be doing that because that's a type error.
He's describing generics. He's completely, delusional. You're delusional.
Wait, we got to finish this.
No, you're not going
to
finish.
No, we need to do that. All right, so here's the deal, all right? In Objective-C,
that is a type error.
Let's you and I talk here. This is bad.
Scott, if you call the same function once with an int and once with a string, that is a type error, right? Aha. Type inference doesn't mean you can't ever have type errors. The type inference says, type error. The type inferrer can say you have a type error.
Well, hold on. You just blow stuff up at runtime.
Hang on a second. Give me this.
No.
I'm thinking about Objective-C where you can blow stuff up at runtime where you can just pass anything you want to.
We have got to stop this because Joel, with all due respect,
Joel,
we're 50 minutes into this and I'm just telling you the comments are not going to go well for you on this one.
That's because you're not letting me explain. All right.
Well, actually, I have a segue because I was intrigued. I do. No, I have a segue in the other sense of the word.
A segue.
Thank you. I mispronounced it as usual. A segue. I would like to segue into a different topic. So you showed to us Visual Studio 2010 Beta 2, which just came out.
Correct? I did. It's true.
Yes, and I was actually, although you know, I try to avoid the new and shiny, the magpie developer problem. I must say, the shininess was very attractive to me.
Was it the splash screen that got you?
It was the non-rectangular splash screen. First of all, let me just let that sink in. Non-rectangular splash screen. Yeah,
so
exactly.
That's like Adobe has been doing.
Exactly. So I thought maybe you could go over like just a few of the highlights in terms of like what's coming, because I haven't really had time to look at it. But
are you serious?
Cool. No, I haven't at all. So
are you setting me up to be a shill?
Not at all. I honestly want to know. For Stack Overflow,
it's written. Does it have type inference of parameter types? Because it's possible. Passing a parameter is an assignment. If you could do it with assignment, you could do it with parameters.
I will tell you a few things, and then Joel will tell us when they were invented. I'll just tell you, and then Joel will say, 1904. And I was there.
It was 1904.
Okay. there's so much. Okay, what do you care about?
So ASP.NET, obviously, MVC.
Yeah, so MVC,
and also some of the core language stuff, like C# 4.0. This is like a real runtime change. This isn't
a
fake.
Yeah, so it's a side-by-side runtime, which means that it was not a fake. There was never a fake runtime change.
Well, in my opinion, .NET's, there were fake runtime changes.
There have been four runtimes. 1.0, 1.1, 2, and 4.
Yes. So we're actually getting a new runtime.
Yes, you're getting a new side-by-side
like
runtime.
Like .NET 3.0 and .NET 3.5, which
you can put. Yeah, you right.
Thank you. Rory backs me up.
You can put 4.0 on a machine with 2.0 and 3 and 3.5, and it will keep running as before.
Nice.
You can have a machine like a Windows Server machine that has different virtual directories and runs 1.1, 2.0, 3.5, 4.0, all on the same machine, and they won't break it. Installing 4.0 won't break your 3.5 app.
Right. So let me just go off the top of my head. So 1.0 was, initial release of .NET. 1.1 was the non-broken version that they finally shipped.
Right.
2.0 actually added generics. I'm just listing the highlights.
Yes,
like,
sir. Yeah.
3.0, I think, was
Link.
No, that was WPF. 3.5 was Link, wasn't it?
Yeah. And 3.0 was
an extension.
WPF, CF.
So my point is there's a few highline features. Of
The big stuff. The big marketing
stuff. Give me the big 4.0 sell. Like, make me believe.
Make you believe in
4.0. Make me believe, again, that I can fly.
Well, MVC2 ships out of the box.
Right.
jQuery ships with ASP.NET regular.
These are not languagey things.
Dynamic. The DLR ships with 4.0.
Okay.
So that means you've got Iron Python, Iron Ruby. You've got also better COM bindings. So if you're going to call COM.
Oh, wow. So wait, Iron Python and Ruby are going to ship like parallel with 4.0? Or is that going
to be? Yeah, they'll probably be out of band. I'm not sure. I'd have to ask those guys. But the DLR is in the box.
Oh, nice. So that's
so that means
fully...
that you could go and you could say, you know, var. you could say, you know, var p equals, you know, python.create runtime and then give it a whatever dot .py and then call it. You wouldn't say var, you'd say dynamic rather, excuse me.
Well, sell me on the code simplification, because to me, one of the smart things about .NET was it sort of got rid of some of the cruft. Like as I went from 2.0 to 3.0 to 3.5, I could use the var keyword, I could use generics. These things simplify my
code.
You
get the property stuff, right? Property set, getter, setter,
yeah,
automatic.
Get set is just one line now.
Sure.
Right. So yeah, there are things that made my life easier.
You could have name parameters in C#.
Oh, name parameters.
Yeah.
That's
nice. Really cool when you're calling com, you don't have to keep saying missing, comma, missing, comma, missing.
Yeah.
You have named?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I just had a comment. I wanted to say, first of all, that I got comments after today's talk where I was told that one of the most exciting parts was where I showed the difference between doing properties in Objective-C and in C#, right? Instead of having to do it in the 5 million line.
That was exciting.
No, it was. And I got to make it clear, too. I just wanted to, because I like Objective-C and I like developing for the iPhone. Apple guys, I'm sorry. I like this stuff. But C#, getting to do all that stuff on one line, just get everything done there was amazing. And people were genuinely really excited about getting to do that for the iPhone, right? And in fact, I'm sorry, can we go back to something in a little while at least that Joel brought up? It's been a while since I've done any Windows development. Now, why would I get so excited about, would you say, like better COM something or other? I mean, is this really?
If you're, so here's the thing. This is Scott talking, not Microsoft talking. I like to think of it as a customer pain release. There's a whole bunch of stuff that people were hurting about. Not necessarily stuff that you, Rory, care about, but people who are automating, doing business problems, automating Word and Excel on this, you know, they're trying to get ish done, would be pretty excited about using the DLR and the COM binder to make things easier.
Right. No, name parameters is huge. Because, yeah, once you have, I mean, and you try to avoid having functions with like 7 parameters, that would be extreme, right?
Word is full of them, like 47 parameter functions.
Yeah. Like,
So another example on the COM side is the ability to do type inference, with dynamic, which is you can have like a PIA, a primary interop assembly, and you like reference a word interop assembly, and that would ordinarily be like a 20 meg file you have to carry around. Now you can just say embed interop assemblies, and it'll look at the types that you use and then just embed the ones that you need, and then at runtime later it'll say, oh well, these types that he has embedded are the same ones as that are installed on the machine. You don't have to ship the PIAs, and it makes your applications smaller.
Right, and you also mentioned there's a dynamic keyword.
There's a dynamic keyword, so you know how you could do make calls with reflection now, right? You could go and
I see.
You could do reflection and like
reflection was so painful,
right? Though. So it's not painful anymore because there's a so you could actually say dynamic, you know, a equals and then wander around the object. You could say calc dot add. And even though it doesn't, you know, you don't know until runtime if it has the add method. It's the equivalent of you know, calc a equals new calculator and then a dot add. And then suddenly you...
Yeah, but this means it's part of the base framework.
This is an IL, though. You can use this in Wasabi, though.
I know, it's awesome. But like, here we are fighting to get back things that were in... No, literally.
Tell that to the Objective-C guys. So, I mean, they haven't even gotten there.
Yeah.
I'm trying to tell you. Why does
it take so long for these things to come out? Because
you taught me of the Objective-C guys.
So what's cool about it is that you can you get binders, you get Python, you get Ruby, you get Calm, you get .NET. So stuff that you were doing that was then like meta programming type stuff and like code, you know, anytime that you were, well, anytime you want basically call site dispatching, dynamic dispatch of methods, and all the framework underneath it to make it fast. That's all included.
Okay.
In the box.
Well, actually, all I need to hear, the money line for me,
script
is it
making
makes
an
reflection
app
not painful.
Oh, yeah.
Is
yeah.
like huge.
Well, and making an app, scriptable. You can take any app and then just say, oh, I'm going to expose these objects and
that
now I can drop in Python and the app is scriptable.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah. I'm going to make Baby Smash Python edition, basically, and like kids could write their own apps using the Baby Smash framework or whatever.
It might be a sort of steep learning curve compared to the regular Baby Smash user.
Right. For infants, I think it may be a struggle, but not for Rock Hard Awesome.
Of course, no. He's way ahead of his time.
It's true.
So what's the ETA roughly on like 4.0, like being available like for real, like shipping?
I'm not sure. I mean, I saw online something about next March, but I don't know. I'd have to check.
Sometime next year, then probably.
Sooner than later.
I'm not
late.
Trying to
Sooner
make
than,
you.
No, no. I'm saying that I honestly don't know. Okay. I read on Twitter, someone said next March. But I'd have to go and check. Beta 2 came out now.
Okay.
So that would be 6 months from now.
Well, what about, okay, so that was the language, which I think is the core thing that's interested in. But what about the IDE? Because I think...
Oh, yeah. So the IDE, like most of the IDE is using WPF now, which means that you can write plugins for the IDE in managed code.
It had a nice icon. I just want to point that out. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the IDE improving. One thing like multi-monitor.
There's an app store for IDE extensions.
Really?
Like you can go tools, extension manager, and you can download dynamically.
Oh,
so check this out.
And pay for it and all that stuff?
No, I don't think about the pay for it part.
How's that a store?
Because it's like a store, but everything's free. So there's an extension.
That's the ultimate store.
So there was this demo that we did internally where there's an internal conference we have. It's kind of like a mini tech ed. Mm-hmm. And you remember the Songsmith thing where you like...
Yeah, totally.
So this guy wrote an extension that embedded Songsmith so you can sing your comments. And it was an example of,
awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Stupid, but awesome.
Yeah, the point was that it was exactly what we did. And what he did was he put in some comments and in the markup for the
Do
comments.
Not mess with this code.
Dragons.
I don't even know how
Dragons
it works.
Be here.
That's like, it's like Sondheim on Sondheim with type inference. You could put in some markup inside of your comments and then key off of that and then literally dropped the Songsmith component into the editor itself.
Right.
So the point is you can interact with the editor in a way that you could never do before.
The editor is much more extensible.
Oh yeah. And you got multi-monitor support.
Oh, that's big.
For the whole thing now.
Right. Well, what were give me the top three things that you noticed when coming into it? Yeah.
WPF apps typically have a bad reputation of being blurry. That's totally fixed. And the speed of WPF is really fast. So Visual Studio 2010 is written mostly in WPF now, but it's as fast as it was in 2008.
Nice. So it just looks better.
It just looks better.
It looked good.
You get like control scroll support in your,
nice.
So you can like zoom in and out of your
zoom in
your
and
fonts.
Out of your code?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
It's pretty cool.
Very cool.
Pretty cool.
There's a whole new redesigned new project dialog box too.
Yes.
In my world for the past year.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had a color coded.
Oh, and the add reference dialog is multi-threaded now.
That was the big deal for me, was getting code completion that mostly worked. We just got refactor for some things. Okay, so you guys are like, oh, it's pretty cool, you know, but I mean, seriously, like when I see Visual Studio, like Visual Studio 2003, I get jealous, right? I mean, it's a totally different world.
We got the IDE thing down pretty solid. Yeah. It's nice. It's nice. Oh, the other thing. .NET 4, the bootstrapper for .NET 4 is like, what is it, like 80% smaller than before?
Really?
You can start installing .NET 4, but downloading less than 1 meg. So it's like a 0.8 meg bootstrapper. And it comes down and there's a client profile if you're only going to install a client app. And then there's a server profile. So if you're going to install, the Rory.net application, it's not going to install ASP.net on the person's machine because it's not needed.
Did I hear you say that compilation is finally multi-threaded for like, actually, this is something I learned actually. On the C side, compilation is just very easy to multi-thread.
Yeah.
But on the
compilation? Well, you can do multi-threaded compilation now in 3.5.
It's kind of.
No, MS build /M and you put the number of processes you want to use.
Yeah, but it doesn't really scale. Whereas the C stuff like, doesn't really scale. Like
you're
crazy.
Pulling that out of your ass. What are you talking about? I've written articles about this.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying. So they fixed that. So now out of the box.
I don't know what has been fixed about multi-threaded compiling, other than the fact that I've been doing it for years.
Well, because when I posted my blog, all the C programmers came out of the woodwork. I'm like, we're going to lynch you because quad core CPUs are huge.
MS Build support multiproc for a long time.
Yeah.
It really has, seriously.
But
speaking of multiproc.
But wait, on the C side, I don't know if you understand, it scales like linearly, like perfectly.
Well, that would be great if you knew how to code C, though.
Well, I don't code C, but that was my point. It's like, I would like to
sorry,
have...
Sorry, I always feel the need to give Jeff crap about never learning C.
10 times as much code to do the same thing in C.
Yeah. Which would be great, because it scales linearly.
Well, like I had a whole caveat around my recommendation. I was like, okay, you don't really need quad core, unless you're a C programmer, then you really need it.
Mm-hmm.
But
seriously, about on the core stuff, the parallel framework extensions is a huge, huge part.
Oh, is that
part.
Shipping now?
Oh, that's in 4.0. It's built in. Nice. It's built in. So that means if you have like a for loop or you're doing like some link and you just want to say, I wish I could do this across multiple processors. You just say parallel.for and then you just for each over stuff. Or if you want to do link that's like a big link query over a huge data set, you could say, from F in whatever dot as parallel dot with degrees of parallelism. And then pick the number of processors you want to use. So then you can take any big enumeration or iQueryable thing over a large list and then do it on multiple procs. And then there's
wait.
You like that? Did you do that too?
I had this thing, this language. There was a
language. Hang on. Joel
is called C-Star, which
Joel's
I ran
UI is blocking right now.
What the heck were those machines that I had in college? The parallel, super parallel
Cray's?
Machines. It was after the Cray.
After the Cray.
Thinking machine?
Concurrent. It was a thinking machine. Maybe it was a thinking machine.
They called Next
it
step?
The connection machine. It was called the connection machine.
Machine.
It just had buckets and buckets and buckets of 83, 86 chips. And there was a language for it called C star. There's another language called Fortran star. And you could run C code and Fortran code. Fortran and C code that it would just automatically massively parallelize for you just by adding little stars in various magical places. It would cause your loops to run in parallel automatically. Yeah. Never
like
helped.
Was that Erlang? Isn't that the language du jour now that people are talking about that does?
It actually, it's
like designed for parallelism.
It's extremely in those days, and this may still be the case. It's extremely sometimes it really doesn't help because you think, all right, I got this big array of things.
Yeah.
Just the cost of moving the data to all those different CPUs. Or to those different cores is actually higher than the amount of time it would take to process them yourself.
Well, we added a bunch of new visualization tools now where you can see all the threads, what they're doing, what they're blocked on, why they're blocked. Oh, historical debugging. It's like TiVo for your debugger.
Like debugging C star code written for the connection machine, which is historical.
But historical debugging, you can actually back up in the debugger.
And that's primarily for threading where the whole thing
No, but I'm just saying you can go forward and you can go backwards. And then I can say drop
backwards.
It.
Wait a minute.
What, you like that?
Like you step, and then
and then back up. Boop. Yeah. And then you can also go and say, well, I want to take this IntelliTrace file and then I want to give it. IntelliTrace is cool because you can then wrap it up and then give it to somebody else. Like remember the Replay TV used to do that? And you can say, here, figure this out. So rather than handing someone a dump, you hand them an IntelliTrace.
Awesome.
And then they just keep debugging from where you left off.
Nice.
Right. Transition
point. We're going to wrap it up, but real briefly, I want to tie into the Apple world. Like what, I know they're very secretive, which is I'm just saying because I'm kind of curious. Like, where are they going? Like with Microsoft, one of the nice things is they're almost too open. Like 2010, we know what's happening, and blah blah blah. So, like, what's next for iPhone? Like, are they going to improve the environment? Are they going to do garbage collection? What are they going to do?
Well, garbage collection already exists in Objective-C 2.0, just not on the phone for some reason. As far as where they're going to go with it, Joel, you were saying, I'm not saying he knows. I'm saying that earlier on, you were talking about how it seems like the people on the Apple side and the Objective-C side have never really looked at anything else. And that is exactly the case. If you go to your own site, if you go to stackoverflow.com, which I visit, anytime somebody asks a question about like MonoTouch, you get five angry comments about, when do you want to learn a new language? Why don't you just use Objective, blah, blah, blah? You know, and, you get all these, you get all these people who are really upset about somebody wanting to learn anything else. So people don't like, I don't want to say that people don't like progress in the Objective-C world, but they just got Objective-C 2.0.
Programmers don't like progress.
They don't have perspective. They don't like listening to you guys talk about these things. I'm thinking, I'm just sitting there with, you know, GDB, like stepping over stuff, hoping that I can inspect a property. I've got to go to the console to inspect a property by hand using key value coding.
See, we're from the future.
You should come to work for Microsoft.
Well, yeah. I mean, I did that once, and it was cool. It was fun and everything. But I like this. It's not suffering. It's challenge. It's
hobby.
Fun.
It's like being a hobbyist.
It feels like the frontier, even though it's actually really old. But I mean, it feels like.
Except you're a hobbyist who's suffering.
I'm a hobbyist who's getting paid and suffering. You
know, making programming too easy cannot end well. Cannot end well. If your compiler took care of everything, if you just sort of. It's like, who needs these Cadillacs where there's no, you don't feel the road.
It's no fun
at all. You're gonna hit a kid and you're not even gonna know. hit a child with your car and the shock absorber is gonna be so good. We gotta sign this off, but I'm not gonna be able to say the phone number of the Stack Overflow hotline because it's not even possible.
Now you're hitting kids with Cadillacs. People are gonna be a little upset.
I literally don't even know where I can put this thing. I can't put it on. I can't put it on Microsoft. I can't put it on Handsome Minutes. The audio.
In
the
this
audio
episode,
is horrific.
Hitting kids with Cadillacs.
No, the audio is horrible. I'm just going to throw this thing up on.
I enjoyed it.
This is going to megaupload.com.
I liked it too. I thought it was good.
It was good.
All right.
Well, Rory and I give
thank
it a thumbs
you, everybody.
Up.
Yep.
Wait. We'll make the audio good. We will. Really. We will. This is going to be Handsome Minutes and Stack Overflow podcast. And
crappy edition.
Contact.
You stop
Stack
that.
Overflow.
Every time I take part in one of your.
If you have any questions for me
edition.
And Jeff, call the Stack Overflow podcast hotline. Oh, there it is. 646-826-3879 or email podcast at stackoverflow.com. There's also a wiki page with the transcript of blog.stackoverflow.com where people who couldn't understand what we were saying because the audio was so bad can
also,
go to read it.
And you can also berate us in the comments. Thank you.
Feel free to berate us in the comments. Now, what's the closing for Hansel Minutes?
This has been another horrific episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.